To give you some idea of this difficulty, an RNA polymerase, which carries out only one of the functions an RNA replicase would need, has been created in the lab. However, it can only perform polymerization of strands 3 nucleotides long, and itself contains 100 nucleotides, implying a search space on the order of 41,000. In other words, the emergence of even the simplest imaginable replicating molecule is only plausible within a highly complex chemical system. A system that includes molecules generally only produced by living systems. It would seem that life is a prerequisite for life. Since the disproof of spontaneous generation in the 19th century, such a maxim has indeed corresponded to our every observation. On the other hand, at all stages of evolution, life has undergone sudden leaps in complexity, each of which admits to the same chicken and egg explanatory dilemma. The question of the origin of life is a special case of a more general question. What is the origin of complexity, order, and organization? One theory that tries to explain the origin of life without a first replicator is known as complexity theory. Elucidated by Kaufman in his book Origins of Order, this theory is an important step toward a biological paradigm no longer based on our culture's present conception of self. In describing the origin of life, Kaufman takes advantage of the order for free concept described above in the Order Without Design section. Complex evolving structures appear in many mathematical, physical, and chemical systems in the presence of certain basic conditions such as feedback. Could life be one of them? The key to Kaufman's account of biogenesis is the idea of an autocatalytic set. Many of the problems with the standard selfish gene theory come from the absurd unlikelihood of obtaining such a molecule from the building blocks likely to be found in the prebiotic soup. In Kaufman's theory, it is not necessary for a molecule to appear that can catalyze its own formation. All that is necessary is to have a set of molecules, each of which catalyze a step in the formation of one or more other molecules in the set. The final step in the formation of each molecule in the set must be catalyzed by another member of the set, a condition called catalytic closure. Based on combinatoric reasoning, Kaufman argues that the emergence of autocatalytic sets is highly probable, if not inevitable, when molecular diversity crosses a certain concentration threshold. And then he has a diagram of an autocatalytic loop, which he describes. Let's look at a simplified example, an autocatalytic loop in which A catalyzes the formation of B, B catalyzes C, C catalyzes D, D catalyzes E, and E catalyzes A. One way to look at it is to say that A is the replicator and uses B, C, D, and E as tools to achieve replication. However, that is an arbitrary designation because we could say the same about any other member of the set. Each is dependent on the others. An autocatalytic loop like this lies at the heart of Kaufman's autocatalytic sets. But it gets far more complicated than that. Imagine a system of multiple loops and chains, loops within loops, mutual cross-feed relationships connecting them, inhibitory connections, preferential reactions given different substrate concentrations. Very soon the picture starts looking very much like a metabolism or an ecosystem. There is still no unequivocally identifiable unit that might be said to be the replicator, but we may impose somewhat arbitrary boundaries on various subsystems within the system and call these parts alive, recognizing that while they might be dependent for certain of their reagents on other subsystems, they are able to maintain a constant internal environment. The resemblance of autocatalytic sets to metabolisms and ecosystems is surely not coincidental. When ecologists draw a nodes and arrows graph of the interdependencies among species, it looks like a vast elaboration of the autocatalytic set pictured above. Moreover, as Kaufman points out, the modern cell is an autocatalytic set in which DNA, RNA, proteins, and various intermediate products all contribute to each other's synthesis. Just as in our autocatalytic loop above, it is arbitrary to say that DNA is a replicator and RNA, proteins, etc., just its tools. Instead of saying that our genes act collectively by coding for proteins to replicate themselves, why not say that the proteins act collectively through catalyzing the chemical steps in DNA transcription and RNA translation to replicate themselves? Stuart Kaufman suggests a self that is cooperative at its very origin, yet his model still carries a subtle projection of separation. Is a cell really autocatalytic? What about a human being? No, at best we can say each contains autocatalytic systems and systems within systems. Each requires a food set of molecules that it cannot produce itself. A human being cannot produce sugar from sunlight, nor the free molecular oxygen our metabolism requires, nor a number of essential amino acids, fatty acids, and vitamins. These substances and their sources are therefore excluded from self. When we wall off a part of an autocatalytic set to define an organism, we recognize a certain arbitrariness to that definition. We could just as easily have named the whole as a unit of life, or a smaller part, just as we could say in a human that our organs are alive, our cells are alive, our mitochondria are alive. True, none are viable on their own, but neither are human beings, nor is any life form at any level. The biological definition of the organism, and therefore of the self, usually draws on the concept of the phenotype, the expression of the nuclear DNA. Already this definition is problematic because DNA is expressed very differently under different environmental conditions. However, the resulting organism is often no more viable, that is, no more capable of survival and replication, than an isolated human organ or cell. Most life forms are so utterly dependent on symbiotic relationships with other life forms as to call into question the validity of phenotypic definition. Without the bacteria in their rumens, for instance, cows would be unable to digest cellulose and would quickly starve. Is the bacteria part of the cow or a separate organism? Or is our identification of discrete organisms as the atomic elements of an ecosystem a source of confusion? It may very well be that, contrary to the selfish gene theory, in which the organism came first and eventually mutated, evolved, and generated the ecosystem, it is in fact the ecosystem that is primary, while organisms are merely semi-autonomous off-buddings that arose after the ecosystem developed a certain level of complexity. If so, the quest to find the first replicator is a diversion, an artifact of a cultural prejudice about the nature of the self as a discrete, independently existing entity. If our boundaries of self were more fluid, as they were in other cultures, more open, less rigid in their demarcation of the universe into self and other, then perhaps we would not be so fixated on finding the replicator and better able to understand a different genesis story. Kaufman's work suggests a story of life based much more on cooperation than on competition. In the simple example of the autocatalytic loop, each element is indispensable to the viability of the whole. Remove one, and the whole system disintegrates. A more complex system, such as an actual ecosystem, is more robust. Remove C, and there will be other pathways to get from B to D, or if not, from B to E. But the loss of one element or one species will still typically initiate a cascade of other losses, causing the entire system to collapse into a simplified but still viable subset of the original. The system is cooperative in another way, too. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Split an autocatalytic set into two pieces, and both may be non-autocatalytic and hence incapable of maintaining themselves away from chemical equilibrium. Autocatalysis, and therefore life, is an emergent property arising out of complexity. Life on all levels is a collective. This is an example, quite literally a living example, of the limits of reductionistic logic. As in any system with emergent order, there is something about the whole that eludes analysis that cannot be understood by taking it apart. Poets have long known that something of a flower is lost when it is reduced to just so many botanical properties of stamen, sepal, anther, and petal, just as life is more than the collection of enzymes, fatty acids, DNAs, proteins, and so forth that make it up. The ideology of science has long been that higher order properties, such as beauty, meaning, and love, are either human projections that are not really there, or simply collective terms for a number of lower order, quote, real phenomena. What is happiness, really? Merely a set of biochemically determinate conditions, hormone levels, neurotransmitter levels, activation of brain regions, etc. Today, however, we can demonstrate mathematically that irreducible higher order properties exist, and we can see them as well in living systems. But my dear reader, when I say life is more than a collection of enzymes, fatty acids, please don't think I am proposing to add yet one more ingredient, an immaterial spirit, to inhabit and animate the body. The truth is far more marvelous. I do not believe in an immaterial spirit, but I do believe in a material spirit. Spirit is not separate from matter. It is an emergent property of matter. On the one hand, yes, there is nothing more than the masses and forces of physics and chemistry, but that does not mean that emergent, higher-order phenomena are unreal. Spirit is just as real as Langtons and highways. It has real effects and real explanatory power, but when we take things apart to look for it, it isn't there. The soul is not just another ingredient in a living being, which is why experiments purporting to prove the soul's existence by weighing the body before and after death are misguided. That doesn't mean it isn't real, though. The same goes for other emergent phenomena like happiness, consciousness, beauty, and selfhood, which puts them forever outside traditional paradigms of engineering and control. As in any complex, non-linear, feedback-ridden system, monkeying with the parts can have unexpected or even contrary effects on the whole, which is why attempts to, quote, manage ecosystems are so problematic. A technology of wholes, rather than parts, will look very different from what we have today, running contrary to the scientific intuitions of the last several centuries. If posed with an herb that has a healing effect, science would take it apart chemically to search for the active ingredient. Happiness was to be explained not as a holistic state of the entire person, but isolated as a limited set of neurotransmitter levels, hormone levels, and related responses. Consciousness was similarly identified in a certain part of the brain, the seat of consciousness. Soil fertility was to be explained reductionistically as well, in terms of percentages of a finite list of minerals and other ingredients. Science was based on distilling, purifying, extracting the active principle, and separating out the dross. Closely related to this goal was the program of control. For once we had grasped the active ingredient in pure form, we could wield it to manipulate reality to our liking. We could make the soil fertile. We could make the patient happy. We could make a medicine in pure form more precisely effective than the original herb containing it. Future technology will emerge from our understanding of all the things that vanish when you take them apart, and that are real nonetheless. It will be a technology of the emergent. When René Descartes pondered the nature of the self, he took the very same approach of isolating the essential principle. In fact, it is our concept of self, enunciated so clearly by Descartes, which has set the template for our investigations into the world as well. Separating out the dross, Descartes arrived at what he believed to be the essential purified kernel of selfhood, a mode of amnes separate from the body, the emotions, the sense impressions and the thoughts, but gazing down upon them, experiencing them but apart from them. Descartes' self is the audience for what Daniel Dennett calls the Cartesian theater, viewing the play of thoughts, experiences, sense data, and emotions on the stage of the brain. But like the original replicator, like the vital principle of life, when we take the self apart to find its essences, we discover that it too is not there. This has certainly been the case in neuroscience, which has found that properties such as consciousness and memory are not localized anywhere in the brain. Buddhism has arrived at an identical finding, that the self has no objective discrete reality, but emerges from relationships spanning the entire cosmos. There are no separate individuals. All are interconnected, interdependent, interdefined. The vision of life, the organism, and therefore the self, as an arbitrarily bounded open subsystem itself composed of numerous interdependent subsystems, and therefore without a discrete objective reality, conflicts with many of the founding assumptions of modern philosophy, medicine, economics, religion, law, and psychology. The new conception of self will give birth to momentous changes in all these areas. The Cartesian self is fundamental to the dualism that informs so much of modern thought. I think, therefore I am. Descartes believed in an irreducible kernel of selfhood or amnes, that is the true I, discrete and separate. That conception of self is wholly consistent with the intuitions of the age of separation. Now, we are discovering that at the very basis of life, no such self exists, and we shall observe that fact again and again, level after level, through the cell, the organism, the ecosystem, and the whole planet. The progressive alienation of ourselves from the community of life, our progressive distancing from nature, is based ultimately on an illusion. The scientific revolution gave voice to this illusion. Today, science is undermining its very foundations. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. The Community of Life. While complexity theory has some serious flaws as an explanation of life's origins, many of its features strongly correspond to a newly emerging understanding of life and evolution. Recent discoveries in ecology and genetics confirm two of the basic implications of complexity theory. One, that life is at its basis cooperative. And two, that there is no absolute integrity of the biological self. These new discoveries imply a different mode of understanding that subverts neo-Darwinism at its very foundation, calling into question the primacy of natural selection and random mutation as agents of evolution. While competition certainly may exist among members of an ecosystem or an autocatalytic set, each also depends on the others to survive. Each has its niche, its essential role and function, that the others would destroy at their own peril. There is no discrete replicating unit, and therefore nothing on which Darwinian laws can operate until much later, when semi-autonomous off-buddings of the set gain enough independence to compete as discrete individuals. But let me emphasize the modifier semi, because no life form is ever fully independent of the rest of nature. When we look at contemporary living systems, we find a situation similar to that of the autocatalytic set. Of course there is competition, but its primacy as a determining factor in behavior and evolution is exaggerated. We tend to find what we look for, and now that the cultural blinders of separation are beginning to fall away, scientists are discovering more and more the overriding importance of cooperation in biology. The extent of these cooperative relationships call into question the very coherency of the concept of an individual organism, threatening, as Kaufman's sets do, to deprive neo-Darwinism of the very subject of natural selection. Let's look at some examples of cooperation in nature, starting with our own cells. Each of our cells are inhabited by mitochondria, which have their own DNA. These bits of protoplasm are parts of our cells and all other animals that are not coded for by our nuclear DNA. In a sense, they are separate organisms. In fact, most scientists now accept Lynn Margulis' theory that mitochondria were originally aerobic bacteria that merged with other cells. Yet without them, we'd be dead, for they provide at least 90% of our energy. Even on the cellular level, we are cooperative beings. On the coast of Brittany, there is a flatworm, Convoluta roscoffensis, that has no functioning mouth or digestive tract. Instead, its transparent body hosts trillions of green algae who provide the worm energy through photosynthesis. In that protected environment, generations of algae live and die. They even process the worm's metabolic wastes. Another worm, a roundworm that lives near undersea vents, also has no digestive tract, but harbors bacteria in a special organ called a trophosome. The bacteria produce energy from hydrogen sulfide gas collected by the worm. What kind of bacteria? No one has named them because they are impossible to culture in a lab. They can only survive in the worm. Bacteria and worm are each wholly dependent on the other. I have already mentioned the dependency of ruminant animals on bacteria to digest cellulose. Recently, evidence has accumulated that humans, too, require a complex intestinal ecology to thrive. Hundreds of species of yeasts, bacteria, and other organisms inhabit the healthy human gut in numbers far exceeding our own cells. They produce K and B vitamins, protect us from colonization by pathogenic bacteria and fungi, assist digestion, and interact with the immune system in ways that are not fully understood. There's even evidence that human beings are meant to host a certain species of parasitic intestinal worms, which have been used to successfully treat hundreds of cases of ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Not just our intestines, but all of our mucosa, skin, and even eyelashes are host to bacteria, yeasts, and microscopic insects that are not competitors drawing down our resources, but partners in health. Since we are partly or even wholly dependent upon them, no less than we are on our heart and liver, By what right do we exclude them from the definition of self? Stephen Buhner gives many amazing examples of cooperation in nature in his beautiful book, The Lost Language of Plants. Quote, "In Central America and Africa, certain species of acacia, a large shrub or small tree, is covered with thorns, some of which are hollow and house ants. Much like co-evolutionary bacteria, pseudomyrmex ants recognize new shrubs as co-evolutionary partners and colonize them. The trees produce special nectar along the stems for the ants to eat. Like the compounds released from plant roots, this nectar contains a rich mix of fats, lipids, proteins, sugars, and other compounds necessary for the ants to remain healthy. The ants remove vegetation from around the base of the plant, remove leaves of other plants that shade the tree, kill any vines that try to grow up the tree, and attack any herbivore that tries to eat the plant." Close quote. Which is the organism, the tree itself or tree plus ants? Most plants could not survive without mycorrhizal fungi on their rootlets, which in turn depend on sugars provided by the plant. A similar relationship exists between legumes and nitrogen-fixing bacteria, except not only the organisms involved, but the entire plant community depends on the fixing of nitrogen. This is typical. Cooperation in nature extends far beyond mutual dependency between plant and pollinator, flatworm and algae. More often, the dependencies are not one-on-one, but highly distributed. Thousands of species in mutually dependent partnership. Just as a mammal cannot survive without a heart or lungs, which justifies including these organs as part of self, so also are these plants, insects, fungi, and so forth, unable to survive without their symbiotic community. Remove one element and the whole system might collapse. Life does not thrive in sterile isolation. Buhner gives a striking example of a community of life in his description of the ironwood tree of the Sonoran Desert. Quote, "Smaller plants begin to appear, continually shaded from the desert sun, cooled by transpired water, and watered daily by hydraulic lift. Some 65 species of plants will come to grow under ironwood. 31 of these will grow nowhere else. This emerging plant community connects to the mycelial network, and plant chemistries flow throughout the network. Wherever plant roots touch, they can share their chemistries directly. All the plants exude volatile aromatics. Some aromatics call in pollinators. Others fall in a continual rain over the plant community into the earth below. The soil takes them up. The companion plants under the ironwood breathe them in. The smaller community plants cover the ground, keeping the soil moisture high. They all release their own unique mixtures of phytochemicals that can blend together with ironwood in maintaining the microclimate and soil community under the tree. As leaves, bark, and limbs age, they fall to the earth, forming a layer of decaying matter. Over the centuries, the tree and its community build up a mound of detritus around its trunk and under its canopy, in effect, becoming an island or archipelago of life and richness amid the desert, a facilitative nucleus of life. Scores of insects, birds, and animals come to the archipelago. They pollinate, spread seeds, build nests from the archipelago plants, dig burrows, mate, aerate the soil, use plant chemistries in their growth, as their medicine, as their food, and contribute over the years tons of their own night soil. Ironwood increases the abundance of life by 88% and species richness by 64% in any area in which it grows. Plants such as the endangered saguaro cactus can rarely germinate outside the kind of zone that trees such as ironwood create. Ironwood and similar trees literally create the ecosystems in which they and other beings live. Close quote. Ironwood communities are unusual only in their relative isolation. In other ecosystems, the same kind of relationships exist among keystone species, the nurse plants, which help them get established, and subordinate plants, which regulate the flow of life and energy through the community. Of course, the community as a whole, which also includes insects, bacteria, birds, mammals, and fungi, does exercise limitations on the proliferation of each member, and in the establishment and maintenance of these, competition surely comes into play. But it is a mistake to try to understand the functioning of the whole community in those terms. Instead of seeing competition as primary and symbiosis somehow arising out of it, it might be more illuminating to see competition as one of several ways by which resource flow is optimized within a living community. Understanding of human communities is crippled in a similar way by insisting on viewing all reciprocity in terms of competitive economics. Some anthropologists have tried to do just this by analyzing trade between individuals or tribes in terms of net caloric gain or net time gain. However, this kind of analysis is motivated by the implicit assumption that calories or time are scarce commodities, and uneven trade would be no cause for concern for people without a concept of time scarcity or food scarcity, and therefore harks back to the assumption that primitive life was a struggle for survival. Orthodox biology holds an identical assumption, and like anthropology, cannot fully apprehend systems in which competition is not primary. Something is always missing. Of course, none of the communities of life described above are autonomous. All organisms and microsystems depend on the health of the ecosystem in which they live, and each ecosystem depends on other distant ecosystems. All higher life forms depend on the bacteria, which maintain a life-supporting atmosphere. While life on Earth can sustain the loss of some species, each species depends on the whole. None can exist in isolation on a bare and lifeless planet. We may thus also consider the only viable unit of life to be the entirety of all life, along with the inorganic processes related to the water cycle and the carbon cycle. The conception of organism as an autocatalytic set is misleading, because no organism is fully autocatalytic. Like the human, depending on essential amino acids, etc., all life forms depend on the rest of life for their long-term survival. The only autocatalytic set is the entire planet, if that. These examples of flatworms and mycorrhiza are not anomalies, not some odd curiosity of nature. They are ubiquitous. Cooperation is everywhere. Life depends on it. Only the cultural blinders of Darwinian survival of the fittest, the dog-eat-dog world, prevent us from seeing it. We live in a cooperative biological world, a living entity which we call Gaia. Some might quibble with the characterization of Earth as a living organism, but it does possess many features of one, most notably homeostatic regulation of temperature, gases, salinity, and other variables. Each species contributes some way to the metabolism and homeostasis of the planet. Coral creates lagoons that help remove salt from the ocean, which would otherwise double in salinity in just 60 million years. Photosynthesizing algae and rainforests produce the oxygen that sustains animal life, while other mechanisms prevent oxygen levels from going too high and sparking devastating planet-wide forest fires. Bacteria accelerate rock weathering to bring carbon out of the atmosphere, while marine animals eventually turn that carbon into shells ultimately sequestered on the ocean floor. And something, some combination of organic and inorganic processes, has kept Earth's surface temperature stable, as the sun's apparent brightness has increased by 30 or 40% over 3 billion years. Gaia maintains homeostasis, responds to external stimuli, and grows, if not in size, at least in complexity. The only attribute of a living being that Gaia does not possess is, we are told, the ability to reproduce. Evolution is often depicted as an arms race, with plants developing ever more sophisticated chemical defenses against predation, while the insects that feed on them try to adapt to those defenses or face starvation. While examples of this do occur in nature, as between cheetah and gazelle, it is actually an unusual situation that we take as typical only because that is what we look for. More typical is the relationship between the Douglas fir and the spruce budworm. During periods of very light infestation, the tree produces no response. But when the budworm numbers begin to grow, the trees alter their terpene releases in a way that interferes with budworm feeding and reproduction. The trees don't try to eliminate the budworm and other pests and take over the earth, but merely help maintain budworm populations at the right level. Many other plants do the same thing, tolerating moderate foraging, but responding aggressively to severe infestation. Others possess compounds that are toxic only in large quantities, such as phytoestrogens that interfere with grazers' reproduction if eaten to excess. With few exceptions, modern human beings are the only living beings that think it is a good idea to completely eliminate the competition. Nature is not a merciless struggle to survive, but a vast network of checks and balances that ensures each species occupies its proper place. Indeed, the extinction of any species usually has negative consequences that spread throughout the ecosystem, often to the detriment of even its former prey. Are the deer better off when they are finally free from the tyranny of the wolves? Only if you think starvation, bark stripping, and the degradation of the entire forest ecology are an improvement. The study of ecology leads toward a view of nature as a vast gift-giving network, rather than a competitive, accumulative network. In his classic work, The Gift, Lewis Hyde observes that in primitive cultures, it was in the essence of a gift that it had to be passed on or consumed. Many cultures actually use the word eaten. Gifts were not accumulated. Similarly, each species, each organism, has something to give to its environment, through which resources flow freely. Even in the case of predation, locations like the deer gave itself to the wolf reveal an unconscious insight that underneath the very real life and death struggle, there is a fateful and intimate connection between predator and prey. Just as hunter-gatherers did not accumulate possessions, animals and plants don't try to make the world theirs by taking over ecosystems and wiping out other species. Opportunistic weeds may, quote, take over an area for a time, but soon give way to more complex ecosystems. Their rapid initial takeover might be a gift to the community as well, for example, by stabilizing denuded soil and preventing erosion. In a gift-based world, the needs of the rest of the community define a purpose to life. Instead of a struggle to survive, life is an aspiration toward excellence in the role presented to each organism or each person. It was only with the advent of agriculture that human beings began to think in terms of eliminating the competition, weeds, wolves, and insect pests. What of the deer problem? We will cull the herd and manage deer populations. What of the diseases that afflict monocultures? We will manage them with chemicals. The project of eliminating the competition coincides with the ambition to order and manage nature, culminating in the total mastery of nature that is the fulfillment of the technological program. Or as a Scientific American cover once put it, managing planet Earth. Today, as a convergence of crises renders life increasingly unmanageable, we are realizing the bankruptcy of this ambition. We need only to look to nature to see the false premises on which it is based. Projecting our own alienation, competitiveness, and survival anxiety onto biology, we have seen life as a Steinerian war of all against all, but nature, like primitive society, is not like that. Yes, there is competition, and there are times of anxiety, hunger, and life and death struggle, but these are merely a few of the strands of existence, not its warp and woof. The entirety of life, Gaia, makes room for each species until its time has passed. We live, as Lynn Margulis puts it, on a symbiotic planet. All of this suggests a very different way of relating to nature, which is another way of saying that it suggests a different mode of technology ever directed at management, subjugation, and supersession of nature will be turned toward fulfillment of our proper role and function within nature. I will share the outlines of such a mode of technology in the next chapter, fleshing out a vision of the future that holds for humanity a beautiful destiny, an ascent, which nonetheless explicitly rejects today's long-standing, consumptive, linear view of progress. Perhaps a better word for this ascent is fulfillment. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. The genetic plenum. A major flaw of complexity theory as an account of life's origin is that it never works in a test tube. Critics of Stuart Kaufman point to the failure in the laboratory to create anything like the expanding, evolving autocatalytic sets he describes. Invariably, instead, we end up with uninteresting tarry gunk sitting on the bottom of the flask at chemical equilibrium. Computer simulations of evolution, where various mutating organisms compete for memory or some other resource, similarly fail to generate genuinely new genes. Artificial life programs like Avida and Tierra appear to simplify and prune genomes rather than generating novel ones. Interesting variations on the original creatures emerge, but not to my knowledge, truly new organisms at a higher level of complexity. The only exceptions I could find are systems like Ray's Tierra, when length is specifically rewarded in the program environment, and Dawkins simulations where fitness is defined by proximity to a predetermined form. Ironically, such systems model intelligent design, not the undirected evolution Dawkins and Ray believe in. Yet leaps in complexity do happen, not only in nature but in human civilization. In direct analogy to Lamarckian adaptive mutation, technological development is not a random search of the entire possibility space of new inventions that are then selected according to fitness. Rather, an awareness of purpose, a goal, an intention guides trial and error and narrows the search space. Scientists believe that such intentionality is only the province of human beings, not genes, not ecosystems, and not the planet as a whole. Creationists believe the same thing, except they ascribe intentionality as well to a supernatural intelligence. No one says that because human society is so complex, interdependent, and tightly coupled, it could never have evolved, but it must have been created this way. The chicken and egg problem of irreducible complexity that plagues selfish gene biogenesis repeats itself on all levels of evolution. Generally speaking, a single mutation in an existing gene cannot produce a new gene with a different function. If two genes differ by only a single base pair, then a single point mutation could convert one into another. Usually, however, these two genes will be regarded merely as variants of the same gene and will have an identical function unless the mutation is at some critical spot that renders the second gene non-functional. The same goes for other basic alterations, such as the deletion or repetition of an existing sequence. To get a gene with an entirely new function usually requires many, many alterations, a concatenation of several unlikely steps, a series of just the right mutations happening either all at once or one after another. Unlikelihood multiplies into impossibility. If I guessed the next card you draw from the deck, you'd be impressed but not amazed. If I guessed 10 in a row, you'd suspect a trick, because that would happen only about once every 50 quadrillion trials. Well, maybe it isn't so unlikely given billions of years for evolution to happen, right? Wrong. To give you some idea of the numbers involved, in 1997, a gene for an anti-freezing protein was discovered in an Antarctic fish that is extremely similar to another gene in that same fish that codes for a pancreatic enzyme, an entirely different function. The two genes are so similar that indeed, a mere handful of mutations, a deletion, a duplication, a frameshift, an insertion of a short intron, and the amplification of a formerly non-coding spacer sequence, can take us from one to the other. However, if we assume that these mutations were totally random, the number of possible genes that can be made from the original by those steps is literally astronomical. 1 in 10^370, according to one author. And remember, these two genes are extremely similar. For most genes, the number of steps to convert one to the other is much greater. The neo-Darwinist solution to the problem is to postulate that each of the intermediate genes has some kind of function that befits the organism's survival, allowing a gradual evolution from a warm water fish to an Antarctic fish. In general, though, getting halfway to a new gene won't give you half of its new function. It's usually all or nothing, or less than nothing, as intermediates might be useless for both the old and the new functions. The authors of the antifreeze paper were aware of this problem, and in a remarkable, though certainly unwitting appeal to teleology wrote, quote, "The selection of an appropriate permutation of three codons was likely shaped by the structural specificity required for antifreeze-ice interaction to take place," close quote. In other words, they realize it couldn't have happened purely by chance, nor is it plausible that each intermediate conferred a survival advantage. The problem is actually even worse than that. In most cases, a new gene with a new and genuinely useful function is only useful in the presence of a number of other new genes that must be expressed at the same time. For example, whatever mutation gives a giraffe a long neck would be fatal in the absence of some other gene to give it a special nasal structure and blood vessel network to cool the brain, and another to create the vascular adaptations that regulate blood flow to the brain when the giraffe lowers its head to drink water. The intelligent design proponent Michael Behe gives similar examples in his book Darwin's Black Box. Most striking is the example of the synthesis of AMP, which is essential to all life. Behe describes 13 steps of AMP synthesis requiring 12 separate enzymes, each of which is basically useless without the other 11. Even if one of the requisite genes emerged through random mutation, in the absence of an adaptive advantage, why would it remain in the gene pool instead of any of trillions of other equally likely mutations? Parallel situation pertains to blood coagulation, which requires numerous proteins and other substances that are highly specific to their tasks and useless outside of them. Both exemplify what Behe calls irreducible complexity, of which Darwin wrote, quote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down," close quote. The extreme difficulty in using gradual random genetic mutation to account for the complex, tightly coordinated systems of biology, added to the fossil evidence for sudden evolutionary jumps, is slowly eroding support for the conventional neo-Darwinian synthesis. A new paradigm is emerging to replace it, one which subverts many of our cultural assumptions about the nature of life. Part of this paradigm shift relies on the adaptive mutations described earlier. However, irreducible complexity poses difficulties even for the adaptive mutation, because not one but many genes for complex, interdependent processes must all appear at the same time. Alternatively, they can appear at different times, but then they must somehow be preserved in the genome without help from conventional selective mechanisms, because they have no beneficial expression. Either way, some coordinating influence is necessary to guide each adaptive mutation toward an outcome that meshes with all others. Whether this force is supernatural, Behe, an environmental purpose, Lamarck, Buhner, Lipton, or the observer effect of the system's own evolutionary future, McFadden. Perhaps the difficulty, again, rests upon our assumptions about the nature of self. Adaptive mutation, even when triggered by environmental purposes, still preserves the gene as a unit of selfhood, albeit an evolving unit. But there is more. While adaptive mutation is certainly part of the story, perhaps the sheer complexity of the cooperative systems described in the last two sections demands an account of evolution that builds cooperation into its fundamental mechanisms, a cooperative account of evolution to complement the cooperative nature of life. According to Lynn Margulis, cooperation, i.e. symbiosis, is not only essential to the survival of all life on Earth, it is also the driving force of evolution. Her theory of serial endosymbiogenesis explains the evolution of the modern eukaryotic cell as the progressive incorporation of simpler organisms. In her view, genuine novelty in evolution comes through the merging of simpler organisms, not through the random mutation of DNA. Organisms, including higher organisms, evolve through the incorporation of external DNA. This has been well documented for half a century in the case of bacteria, which have been closely studied to determine how they achieve resistance to antibiotics. While occasionally a point mutation will confer resistance, for example, through the alteration of some surface protein, normally bacteria import resistance-encoding genes from other bacteria via viruses, conjugation, and other means. And it's not just resistance. Recent studies have demonstrated that the genes for photosynthesis are also transferred horizontally among bacteria. This phenomenon, named horizontal gene transfer, HGT, was observed in plants as long ago in the 1940s in Barbara McClintock's pioneering studies of corn. More recently, evidence has mounted that HGT is also common in multicellular animals, even in humans. The following press release describing bacterial photosynthesis might therefore be generalized to all evolution. Quote, "The analysis revealed clear evidence that photosynthesis did not evolve through a linear path of steady change and growth complexity, but through a merging of evolutionary lines that brought together independently evolving chemical systems. The swapping of blocks of genetic material among bacterial species, known as horizontal gene transfer," close quote. A major piece of evidence for HGT in nature is the presence in unrelated organisms of similar DNA sequences that, based on molecular clock evidence, cannot be explained through common ancestry. While viruses are probably the main vector of gene transfer, there is also laboratory evidence for direct bacterial transmission of DNA into mammalian cells. Other possible vectors include, in the words of one researcher, external parasites, infectious agents, intracellular parasites, and symbionts, especially those in the germline, DNA viruses, RNA viruses, retroviruses, even hitchhiking in other transposable elements, close quote. The primary vectors of HGT, whether viruses or other parasites, are not merely germs or invaders, but carriers of genetic information from organism to organism and species to species. In one study, researchers found that DNA from T. cruzi, a protozoan which causes Chagas disease in humans, had been incorporated into the nuclear DNA of laboratory rabbits and passed on to their offspring, thus having entered the germline. Some scientists have even put forth evidence that the incorporation of viral DNA initiated the speciation event in which human beings and chimpanzees diverged 6 million years ago. These are not controversial findings by fringe scientists, but are reported in prestigious mainstream journals, as a cursory examination of this section's footnotes will confirm. It is becoming increasingly apparent that eukaryotic genomes, including humans, are riddled and perhaps even dominated by the remains of viral DNA incorporated into the germline millions of years ago. As Lynn Margulis puts it, we are our viruses. But let's not limit ourselves to the uncontroversial. Perhaps the integration of exogenous DNA into the human genome is ongoing and purposive. The great epidemics of agricultural civilization may have contributed important genes bearing adaptive utility for humans living in dense populations and carrying out civilized lifestyles. In particular, non-lethal viral diseases like measles, mumps, and chickenpox, which were pandemic until the era of vaccines, might comprise an important alternative transmission system for genetic material. Perhaps they are our symbionts, having adapted with us into a mutually beneficial relationship. If so, eliminating them could be dangerous. The precise consequences are hard to predict, but perhaps it has something to do with the alarming rise in autoimmune diseases and allergies over the past 30 years. Orthodox genetics maintains, because of the slowness of evolution, that we are essentially the same species as our Stone Age ancestors 20,000 years ago. But if viral DNA is regularly incorporated into the germline, it is conceivable that the diseases of civilization are an agent of speciation, triggered by the population concentrations that come only with agriculture. Could it be that humanity is undergoing speciation right now? If, as Bruce Lipton argues, our emotions, thoughts, and beliefs can modify our DNA, could speciation even be a matter of choice? Do we have the opportunity to literally become what we choose to be? And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That is Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. And I'll continue next week as he lays out this liberating vision. But you need not wait till next week, because he has a website, ascentofhumanity.com, where you can read this entire book, find out about events, see videos, send him email, whatever you wish, ascentofhumanity.com. And you can download copies of this episode and all previous episodes of the show on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you once again for listening.